Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We're going to give the salmon a sauna of a lifetime. I've got some of Tim Burton's maple syrup from Burton's Maple Camp, and this stuff is good.
And it tastes great with just about anything. That salmon will be broiled on a cedar plank. Then Chef Daniel Orr gives turnips a maple syrup makeover. From Harvest Public Media, the market for man-made fibers is going up. The demand for cotton worldwide is going down. What's an American cotton farmer to do? Another story from the farm, prices for corn and soybeans are dropping. Some farmers think this might be a good time to grow crops that can help protect their soil. And what if your barista could talk to your roaster to make sure that shot of espresso is the best it can be? That's how things work at Hopscotch Coffee. Here are the news stories we followed this week with Mark Chilla.
The European Union was slated this week to consider whether to extend approval for glyphosate, a key ingredient for herbicides such as Roundup. But Reuters, citing anonymous EU sources, reports that the decision will be tabled due to a simmering feud over whether the chemical should be considered safe. The EU's Food Safety Board has stated that glyphosate is unlikely to cause cancer, a conclusion that contradicts findings from the World Health Organization, which calls the chemical a likely human carcinogen. France, the Netherlands, and Sweden oppose the EU Food Safety Authority report that says the chemical is safe. Glyphosate is banned in many parts of Europe because of its alleged links to health problems. France said last week it would not support renewal for the glyphosate license, which expires in June. Hundreds of lawsuits against seed company Syngenta could evolve into a major class action that could involve almost every corn farmer in the country. In 2013, China rejected some American imports because they contained corn grown from a seed with a genetically engineered Syngenta trait. The trait was approved for sale in the United States, but China's regulators had not yet approved it. China is a huge market for U.S. corn. Lawyers have filed many cases on behalf of farmers seeking compensation from Syngenta for lost sales. Many of those lawyers are asking the court to combine the cases into a class action. Syngenta denies any wrongdoing, and in a statement said the lawsuits have no merit because the seed was approved for sale here. Social media has changed the way we talk about food and opened vast frontiers for food researchers to study. Now, researchers at Georgia Tech have started using Instagram to compare food pics and hashtags posted in so-called food deserts. The group crunched data from 3 million geotagged Instagrams with a slew of hashtags like cupcake, pizza, and beetroot, as well as telltale exclamations like epic, yum, and foodgasm. The study cross-referenced those posts with nutritional information and found that food shared from food deserts were higher in cholesterol, sugar, and fat. Using a model based on this data, the researchers were able to correctly predict 80% of the time whether or not an Instagram food pic was taken in a food desert. Another study recently mined Instagram to look at the good choices of adolescents and found that nearly 68% of the foods they shared were high in calories but low in nutrients. And Giant Eagle calls it produce with personality. The Pennsylvania grocery chain has started selling fruit and vegetables that don't meet traditional beauty standards and offering them at a steep discount. As NPR reported, a 4-pound bag of blemished navel oranges, for instance, currently costs $2.99 a bag. The conventional version sells for $4.99 a bag. Whole Foods announced a plan to partner with a company called Imperfect Produce to start selling less attractive fruits and veggies next month in some of its California locations. These stories are all posted at eartheats.org.
Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Amy Mayer for the news update, and of course, Mark Chilla.
You got it.
Cotton fabric has been a staple of our closets for decades, but times are tough for farmers in the U.S. Cotton Belt. They're caught in the middle of a storm of changing global demand. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted visited Missouri cotton farmers and found them hoping for a rebound.
When I enter the town of Seneth, Missouri, near the Arkansas border, I pass a sign welcoming me to Cotton Country. Charles Parker has been growing cotton here with his family since the 60s. Today, he's driving through his empty fields toward his cotton gin.
Everything around here was cotton, just pretty well wall to wall cotton. This past year, there was corn and some milo and soybeans and cotton, so we were kind of a minority this last year.
Across the cotton belt, from Georgia to Arkansas to Missouri to Texas, cotton acreage has been shrinking over the past few years, and many cotton gins closed up shop alongside. Parker says he and a few other growers banded together to buy a gin to keep their operations going. In a good year, he'd gin more than 90,000 bales.
In 2014, we were down, and we ginned like 65,000 bales. This last year, with the acres down, we ginned 35,000 bales.
Cotton acreage in the U.S. has been declining for years, with 2015 hitting the lowest mark in decades. U.S. producers are also facing growing competition from countries like India and Pakistan.
One of the main issues also affecting the world's cotton market is just a sluggish demand.
Jody Campici is with the National Cotton Council. She says it boils down to one thing, China. China used to be the largest export market for American cotton. Something like 40% of U.S. cotton exports ended up there. Last year, just 6%.
So it's really kind of changed the world market and the way that U.S. producers have to compete in the world market.
A lot of our clothes are made in China, but clothing companies there are relying more and more on cheaper, man-made fibers like polyester. My tan shirt says made in China and 100% cotton. My Mervin's shirt. Even the clothes in my closet tell the story of the shift away from cotton. Oh, wait, there it is. 35% cotton, 65% polyester. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a big reason man-made fibers are on the rise is growing consumer demand for athletic wear. Think moisture-wicking fitness clothes. Under Armour leggings to shoot like Steph Curry. 100% polyester. Basketball shorts. Polyester. All that polyester in my closet has cotton growers in the South and Midwest looking for federal help. Justin Roan grows cotton in southeast Missouri.
There is very little farm safety net for cotton right now. If you plant cotton, your farm safety net is almost non-existent.
Many farmers have turned to planting other crops like corn and soybeans, looking for a little more security. The cotton industry is asking federal lawmakers to help protect growers from down years.
We're seeing that now as other commodities have a stronger farm safety net below them. Cotton does not.
This year, though, prices are down for crops just about across the board. So farmers like Roan and Charles Parker are planning to plant a little more cotton acreage and hoping for strong yields.
I think as long as we can continue to have the high-quality production that we have and we continue to have favorable weather, we can produce some of the most affordable cotton, some of the most highest quality cotton in the world here.
Small demand growth in countries such as Mexico, Vietnam, and Bangladesh have been helping U.S. cotton exports, but they're not enough to offset the recent drop. Ultimately, growers say all eyes will be on China and all of the t-shirts, pants, and leggings made there that end up in the closets closer to home. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today, with prices of commodity crops down, some farmers are considering changing up what they grow in their fields. It's the maple syrup time of year. The National Maple Syrup Festival was held in Brown County, Indiana last weekend. This weekend, sugaring operations around the state are hosting a slew of maple syrup-themed events. You can see how it's done, from primitive techniques to the most modern ways of tapping trees and boiling sap to syrup. Chef Daniel Orr works with Tim Burton, a Burton's Maplewood farm, when he needs the sweet stuff for his recipes. Daniel keeps massive containers of Burton's Grade A and B syrups in the kitchen. We picked two recipes from our archives that highlight how to use maple syrup in your cooking. First up, with salmon.
And what we've done is we've got a cedar plank here. You can smell that. Smells kind of like a sauna.
It does.
You know, and we're going to give the salmon a sauna of a lifetime, Just giving, I've got some of Tim Burton's maple syrup from Burton's Maple Camp.
1 gallon jug of the stuff.
And this stuff is good. Okay, we're going to put a little bit of red onion. Okay, I've got a little bit of Meyer lemon. My cousin Heather down in Florida she steals Meyer lemons from her neighbor and sends them up to me. And then you can take this whatever direction you want. You know, Chef Dan loves his lemon zest, loves his little crushed red pepper flakes. Okay, we're going to just kind of turn the salmon over in the mixture. And what the maple syrup's going to do is it's going to kind of intensify the smokiness of the cedar plank we're using, as well as caramelize. So get a nice kind of caramelization. All right, so what I'm going to do is I've got the smoking plank. I'm going to put a couple of the slices of Meyer lemon down. Then we put the salmon right on top. It's a little more delicate this way. You also get the acidity of the lemon. Okay, and we're going to put that back up under the broiler. And we're going to let that cook through. I like my salmon still, you know, medium rare on the inside, so kind of translucent pink. Some people like it well done. What I would suggest is you just keep a good eye on it. You can always stick a little knife in the thickest part of the salmon and open it up and make sure it's to your liking. And if you're getting too much smoke, you can always toss it in the oven and finish it off in the oven. We're going to let that cook for, I would say, 5 to 7 minutes, depending on the heat.
We'll leave the salmon while it cooks. A side dish now, especially good if you have a lone turnip in your crisper.
Well, turnips, you know, they're kind of a forgotten vegetable, an old-timey vegetable, but they are delicious. And their whole dishes in France called navarins, which are all about the navet, which the French turnip in French is navet. And so a navarin is a stew made with turnips. It usually has lamb in it, so that's a wonderful dish. We're going to do something more kind of Hoosier and down home. Using Tim Burton's maple syrup. So what you need to do is pick out a nice turnip. They should be shiny. See how that it's kind of shiny, and if you feel the texture of it, very, very smooth. If it's wrinkly and soft, then it's not going to be good. It's going to become kind of bitter from being in storage too long. If you can get them with the greens, the turnip greens are edible as well. Cook them just like anything else. If you love pork, throw some bacon in there, stew them down. Delicious. If you don't, you could use some toasted walnuts with them, a little bit of balsamic vinegar, great way to cook the turnip greens. Again, a little bit of sweetness always helps with the greens too, because they can be a little bit bitter. So just a little bit of honey, agave, even some brown sugar would be fine, just a pinch. You don't want to be sickly sweet, just to kind of cover up that touch of bitterness. So basically with the turnip bulb, what we're going to do is dice it up. I would say about half inch pieces, and then steam it off. It should still be a little bit crunchy. All right, so we have these ready. They're cooked, they're hot, they're kind of steaming. Now we're going to put together the sauce for them. So just a touch of oil, minced onions, teaspoon, garlic. Just going to let those become a little tender. We don't want them to be super soft. And I'm going to throw a couple dried chili peppers. We're going to leave them whole. And that way we can take them out. So if you're wanting to get a chili flavor, but you don't want to have it too hot, so that's always a good trick. I just added about 2 tablespoons of maple syrup. And now I'm going to add some chopped kumquats. I've got 4 kumquats. They look like little tiny oranges. And you can eat the whole thing. You can eat the skin and all. You can squeeze out the seeds, but I even eat the seeds. And they've got a really nice perfumey orange flavor. Okay, we're going to dump our turnips in, and that's about 1 large turnip. This would be enough for a side vegetable for probably 4 people. And finally, just to make it a little bit better, we got my butter, and the butter is going to enrobe the turnips, give them a nice shine.
Maybe that's the thing. I'm not cooking my turnips with a tablespoon of butter.
Well, the butter, I mean, when you're eating all these great local vegetables, a little butter is going to make them even more special and something to look forward to. Okay, I got the sweetness, touch of spice to get that little bit of orange flavor. I'm going to throw in some greens just to make them look pretty. This is some chopped parsley and scallions. I'm going to put these out on the plate. You can give them a try.
Nice. Simple. A great recipe to keep in mind as the season goes along and you start collecting more and more root veggies. 5 to 7 minutes later, and now the salmon looks good to come out from under the broiler.
dousing the fire. I think the plank has seen its last salmon fillet. All right, we're going to give this a taste. This
will be the fattier part.
Toward the end?
Towards the end, that's the belly part. And then this will be the meatier part. And so if you take a little bit of that, try that, it will taste different from the other side.
Sure.
Taste a little of that maple.
That maple syrup is so nice. It's not sweet. It's not in your face. Mm-hmm. Oh.
And that squeeze of fresh lemon after you pull it out of the broiler or off the grill. And then this is great to serve with something like this, either escarole or an endive, curly endive, because this has a touch of bitterness. The maple syrup and the salmon has a touch of sweetness, so it really has a nice balance. You want to play off those five flavors. You know, your sweets, your bitter, your salty, your spicy, your umami, all those different flavors are at work here.
Cedar plank ablaze. See the photo that goes with this recipe at eartheats.org. Next week, we'll talk to a maple syrup maker about how this season has been for him. In a word, weird. You can get Earth Eats automatically delivered to you by subscribing to the podcast in iTunes. Coming up, we talk coffee.
Can you do a car talk version of making an espresso drink, like grinder noise, banging the portafilter, and then slamming it into the machine?
I don't know if anyone wants that.
Jane Coopersmith and Jeff Grant. One roasts the beans, the other brews the coffee. We hear about a business that thrives on cooperation. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Driving through the Midwest can feel like passing through a sea of corn and soybean fields. That's because those two crops make up about 40% of what's grown here. But now, low grain prices and increasing pressure to clean up waterways may push some Midwest farmers to consider other options. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the changes are likely to come slowly, and there are plenty of obstacles in the way.
Before farmers plant anything, they need to know they can sell it. Right now, things are set up to make selling corn and soybeans relatively easy. That makes it risky and challenging for commercial-scale farmers to change what hundreds of acres will grow, even when they think it might be good for their land.
We're in Taylor County in southwest Iowa, 2 hours southwest of Des Moines.
Here in Taylor County, steep hills of dark soil are lined with the beige stalks of last season's corn. But even in late winter, some fields offer a hint of plant life.
I'm known as that green farm out east in Newmarket.
Kelly Tobin and I are looking out at a field not of corn, but of rye. Tiny shoots are just barely tinting the near-frozen ground with specks of green.
I've always been an innovator, and I always like to do things and try. So we always experiment every year on something different. And so this is a project that I wanted to build up the organic matter.
Tobin says cover crops like this will do that. They grow opposite the corn and beans and put down roots that keep soil and nutrients on the fields. Tobin illustrates the challenge for a modern farmer. He could plant alfalfa on some of his fields to help nurture the soil, but that would mean planting less corn and likely less money.
How can you sell the alfalfa, or how can you? But I think where there's a will, there's a way, and we'll figure out something.
Years ago, Tobin raised cattle that ate the alfalfa hay. The rolling hills here once housed many more cattle and grew fewer acres of crops. Some researchers think integrated systems with varied crops and livestock could benefit the land. Iowa State University agronomist Matt Liebman's data show that adding alfalfa into a corn-soybean rotation can actually increase future corn yields. Without livestock, farmers just have to be more creative to make the economics work.
Sometimes you see farms that don't have livestock but are growing hay work with neighboring farms that are feeding livestock, and the manure can come back to the crop farm.
The prices for corn and soybeans have dropped in recent years. That means now might be the time to take a look at growing crops that can help soil or protect water.
I'm proud to introduce you to Dr. Matt Liebman, the most interesting man in the world.
Liebman presented his research at a recent day-long meeting sponsored by the local Soil and Water Conservation District. Ronald Taylor attended. He still keeps about 50 cows and grows alfalfa, in addition to corn and soybeans. But he may do more.
It's a little more ideal time to try something new on some of that high productive ground.
Despite the challenges, growing alfalfa every few years or putting down a cover crop doesn't force farmers too far out of their existing systems. That adds to the appeal and the likelihood that farmers will give it a go.
Sometimes that's the frustration about our system here, is that all new things seem to have to fit into the current paradigm.
Iowa State University agronomist Mary Wiedenheft is thinking bigger. While climate and soil dictate what we can grow, pockets in the Midwest of wheat or popcorn or pumpkins could be something more.
Why can't we change that paradigm?
She knows it's a tall order. U.S. farmers do raise more than 24 different field crops, many of which feed people as opposed to livestock or cars. Most are small players in the Midwest. Add up all of the acres of canola, sorghum, and wheat, and you'll still have less than half of all corn acres. Wiedenheft says there's plenty of room among the rows and rows of corn and beans in Iowa, for instance, to grow other crops, too.
I'm not interested in completely replacing 11 million acres of corn or 11 million acres of soybeans. I'm interested in a patchwork and diversity on the landscape. I don't want another monoculture.
Some summer day, driving through farmland could be a little less monotonous. Change takes time, but with that, sunflower might brighten up the leafy green quilt of Corn Belt farmland with contrasting blocks of bright yellow petals. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
This group of reporters posts their stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. We like to look at the relationships behind our food. Starts with a farmer, maybe goes to a chef, then to your plate. In coffee, you can add a couple more links to that chain, farmer to roaster to barista to customer. It's the partnership in the middle that we're interested in today. Jane Coopersmith started roasting coffee beans in her house in ultra-small batches, like we're talking one bag at a time. Jeff Grant has worked as a barista in several shops over the years. Their coffee worlds collided, at first reluctantly, 2 years ago when they opened Hopscotch, a coffee shop with an in-house roastery. As they describe it, their best coffee is always the result of collaboration.
I needed a partner because I knew I was really interested in the cafe part of coffee,
right?
Not just the roasting part. But I also knew I didn't have that expertise, and there aren't enough hours in the day for a person to wear all those hats.
Definitely not. The idea of a partner had never really crossed my mind, so I was trying to see into the future as much as I could. And
what's funny about
that was gonna go.
Is that everybody kept saying, "Don't get a partner. Like, whatever
right.
you do, don't get a partner.
Yeah,
then you're stuck together, and then it's like, you know, you're with those people for life."
Right. I'm sure it could be very hard. I've seen it go the wrong way before. You know, people get in business together and then they don't speak to each other anymore sometimes. Definitely didn't want that. I was just trying to imagine if I had tried to start a coffee shop and was getting beans roasted from another state or something. I was just imagining them like showing up in the mail, and I was imagining trying to ask the roaster questions about a bean and not being able to. And it just kind of made me think about how valuable that is, where I'm like, hey, what's up with this coffee bean you roasted this morning? when we were trying to make the cold brew, it's pretty typical for people that make cold brew to like make a blend and kind of get the best quality of each bean. And we ordered a Bolivian bean and roasted it fairly light, and it was just, I just thought it was perfect. I was like, right out of the gate, it was like, yeah, that's the cold brew bean. Like,
we both felt that way.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of our favorite beans. We think it's really special. You get the tasting notes when you drink the cold brew. The tasting notes are like milk chocolate with caramel sweetness and lemon acidity and a little bit of almond. And you taste that, especially the almond and the lemon. It's really amazing. It's so clean and bright. You know, we'll order a bean, we'll sample it, and we'll think maybe it's going to have a particular personality or go one way. And then it's just always fascinating to put something on the espresso machine and see how it comes out.
Mm-hmm. What's the one that I'm blanking on it?
I think that like Humbella.
Yeah.
We were trying it as our single origin espresso. It's a single farm Ethiopian, which is really rare. The Ethiopian coffee commodity system operates sort of like in the Midwest. I use the analogy of the grain elevator. There's all these small farmers that take their coffee beans to what's called the washing station, but it's sort of the equivalent of the local grain elevator. So then you'll get your coffee from a particular region in Ethiopia, but it'll basically be like all the tiny farmers in that area. So there's a lot of variation in the beans. But anyway, this Humbella is from a single farm. And so what that means is that it's way more consistent, high-quality picking of a single varietal in a single location, processed at a single place. So it's, I feel like that natural Humbella has been my number one fave of anything that we've had.
Yeah, me too, probably.
Yeah. So we tried it on the espresso machine, and we're pretty into it. And I don't know what made us decide. We had already been letting it rest, like, 4 or 5 days. Then we decided to let it go 2 weeks before we put it in the espresso machine. It was just mind-blowing.
Yeah, like how long the bean rests after it's been roasted. And that's something we've played with. Like, I think Jane is better at seeing a bean's potential. Like, I'll try something and be like, oh, this isn't working. I've tried it. I've done everything I can do. You know, and I think you're better at realizing, oh, I think, like, it tastes like it needs to rest longer. That's something I'm not as good at identifying as you are.
Granted, I can be a nuisance sometimes too. Things aren't ready as soon as Jeff needs them, and that's really obnoxious. But
well, if we want to get into the
that side of things.
Jeff Grant and Jane Coopersmith of Hopscotch Coffee in Bloomington, Indiana. We've posted pictures along with the audio of this story at eartheats.org. Special shout out to audio engineer Casey Zakin for her help with this story.
A small latte. That's it.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks to you for being here today. Earth Eats out. I'm Annie Corrigan.